From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, open lines and also a special tribute to the late Art Bell, who passed away a year ago. It's hard to believe it's been a year already. My gosh. Here's what's happening. The Federal Consumer Protection Safety Commission and Fisher-Price are officially now recalling all of the company's Rock and Play sleepers, with the commission linking the product to more than 30 infant deaths in 10 years. How tragic. The recall will impact 4.7 million sleepers, according to the commission. They aren't saying exactly what has caused the infants' deaths, except the infants have rolled over while being unrestrained. What a sad story that is. My gosh. A man lit himself on fire just outside of the White House on Friday. Secret Service agents responded to the reports just after 3 p.m. that a man had set himself ablaze while positioned along the White House north fence line. The suspect was operating an electric wheelchair-type scooter when officials say that his outer jacket caught on fire. He was immediately met with uniformed division officers who put out the flames and administered first aid to him. The man was taken to an area hospital, treated for non-threatening injuries there. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has said he is open to a third summit with President Donald Trump, but set this year's end as a deadline for Washington to offer mutually acceptable terms for an agreement to salvage the high-stakes nuclear diplomacy. I hope that works out. As we've been reporting, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was dramatically arrested and carried out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London Thursday. British and Ecuadorian authorities engineered the timing and nature of the raid to stop Assange from accessing a panic button that he mentioned that he had in the past. Now, specifics on the button or what it might do are kind of sparse, but the foreign minister said Assange had said that it could bring dire consequences for Ecuador. Ecuadorian officials have accused Assange of accessing the government's security files, playing music loudly, having no regard for personal hygiene during his stay at the embassy. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us here. John, your take on this entire Assange situation.
Well, I mean, one thing, George, people think, you know, the left wing or people reporting on it from the media want to make it out like Assange is a journalist, and that he's protected under the same rules and, you know, international journalism, basically. The truth is he's a computer hacker, and he's a blackmailer, and he's a criminal. And, you know, like Edward Snowden, you remember that guy that's living in Moscow now in exile, who stole all those files from government, you know, Defense Department computers. The same thing is true with Assange. He worked with Chelsea Manning, formerly Edward, I think it was Edward Manning before, now it's Chelsea, who stole 700,000 documents from a DOD computer. And Assange worked with him in 2010 to hack the security code on another computer that would have given, I mean, access to Manning to unlimited classified government files. So in 2013, the government filed a criminal complaint against Assange in 2013 in Virginia, you know, saying basically that he had tried to crack a code while he was in custody at the Ecuadorian embassy, which the immunity agreement that he had was that he no longer engaged in these stealth operations of his. Well, we know that he broke that this year, by releasing a bunch of dirt on the Vatican. So, you know, and this guy had Assange, who looked like a pretty dapper fellow in some of his earlier interviews.
In the earlier ones, not anymore.
The earlier ones, has completely deteriorated right now to the point that he's probably psychotic. And the Ecuadorian, you know, the new president of Ecuador said, what are we doing with this guy? The guy is smearing feces on the walls of the embassy. He's gone out of his mind. He's mad. And they just said, that's enough of it. And yet you have all these people rushing to his defense saying, oh, my God, this is a precedent. How can we let this happen? How can you let what happen? He's a criminal that has gone completely insane right now.
All right, John. John's website, onlinecolumnist.com. Thank you, John, very much. What a bizarre story this one is. British comedian Ian Cognito died while performing his stand-up in England. He was on stage. He was 60 years old. He died of a heart attack. People in the audience roared and cheered, thinking it was part of his act. And then they realized he wasn't moving, and they checked him out, and he was dead. Strange. Well, if you're having a rough day, one way to turn that frown upside down may be as simple as doing just that. A new study reveals that smiling actually makes people feel happier. Researchers from the University of Tennessee and Texas A&M say, in fact, that several of our emotions can be manipulated to a degree by our facial features. Smile when things are down. Preliminary data from the Israeli spacecraft suggests a technical glitch in one of its components caused that lander yesterday to crash on the moon. Well, it's a pretty marvelous feat just getting there, I guess. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you have for us this week?
Well, good evening, George. It's been quite a week, and I see that our trusty webmaster, Christian Stepien, got a whole bunch of reports posted to our website tonight,
great,
and
great.
Among those are the following. First, three of them are from our past sighting reports. First one comes from Austin, Texas, specifically from Bergstrom Air Force Base. The author of the report thinks it was either 1965 or 66. He was a crew member aboard a B-52 bomber. He was standing on the end of the runway at Bergstrom Air Force Base, and he asserts, together with a crew member, a very large disc-shaped object with porthole windows in the sides of it go right across the runway at Bergstrom Air Force Base. I'm going to send that report to Dr. Robert Hastings, who wrote UFOs and Nukes. I suspect he'll be interested in that one.
Sure will.
Next one, 2 years later, Bucksport, Maine, just north of Castine and Penobscot Bay on the coast of Maine. A gentleman writes that he was upstairs in his home. His mother called him, and he ran outside only to see an 80-foot, they estimated a craft, 80 feet in length, hovering across the highway from their house. The top of it looked like it was rippling mercury, he says. Jeez. The bottom of it was very peculiar blue, and lightning bolt-like shafts of light were shooting out of the bottom of it. Very interesting report, and is now posted to the website. More recently, Lake Ponderay, Idaho, just east of Spokane, not far from where I'm sitting, two adults, husband and wife, were out rock hunting, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, they...
Rock hunting at 2 o'clock in the morning,
2 o'clock in the morning. I was a little suspicious of that, George. But it turns out that rock hunters do that often because some minerals show up quite well at night under ultraviolet illumination.
Or the moonlight or something.
Or the moonlight. Yeah. They heard something coming at them at very high speed from across the lake, and they think that it went between them. They could hear it climb up in a slope above them very rapidly. Very interesting report, very peculiar incident. Much more recently, specifically last Thursday, this makes it the 4th of April, 10:15 p.m., takes us back to Austin, Texas. A gentleman writes that he saw white light moving across the sky at blistering speeds. It suddenly stopped. The illumination ended, and it split into two objects, two red lights that suddenly accelerated and flew away from the point where the white light had extinguished. Very peculiar report, but I mention it because within 4 hours, a young woman writes from Salinas, California, she saw a ball of light in her bedroom, and she looked into it, and she could see, she asserts, two eyes, a slit for a mouth, and the creature inside that ball of light, about the size of a basketball, was looking back at her. She was terrified by it. I'm going to gloss over the last two reports just very briefly. One from Fauk, Arkansas, southwestern Arkansas. A guy saw a meteor or something very unusual streak across the southwestern sky. At about the same time, a gentleman in Tampa, both of them sound to be very solid witnesses, saw something similar, perhaps the same object. No tail, no fragments, probably not meteors, but going like a bat out of hell, they said. So lots going on, and just received minutes ago a report from Sherwood, Oregon, on the southwestern corner of Portland, something very similar to what these two gentlemen from Arkansas and Florida had reported.
Wonder if it's the same object, Peter. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week. Up next, science fiction author and writer Mark Zakrie joins us with some great stories and the new Twilight Zone companion. I love that song. I've always loved that. Since 1959, I've always loved that. The Twilight Zone. I feel like Rod Serling when you walk out and do that. Well, almost somebody like Rod Serling, Mark Zakrie with us, the author of The Twilight Zone Companion. He's a science fiction author, television writer, screenwriter. He has been nominated for several of the industry's awards, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Mark, always a pleasure, my friend. How you been?
Really well, George. It's terrific to be with you tonight.
What do you think every time you hear that Twilight Zone theme?
Oh, it's, you know, a shiver goes up my spine. It was like you. I saw the show when it was on the air and on the network, and it was one of the greatest shows ever made, and it made me who I am. So it's just an amazing, unique, wonderful show.
Earlier this week, I had a feature on. It's called Who's Behind the Secret Door. A number of guests are on the show. And unlike you tonight, where I know it's you,
yes.
I don't know who they are. I have to guess who they are, and one of them was Billy Mumy.
Wow.
And he tricked me, and I didn't get it right, but we went and talked. We talked about you a little bit.
Yeah.
And what a great talent.
Yes,
but he was in three Twilight Zones, he told
me. Yes, he was in three great episodes. He was in, the best one, of course, is It's a Good Life, where he sends people to the cornfield with chlorophyll.
You're a bad, bad man.
Phenomenal. And then in Praise of Pip with Jack Klugman, which is great. And then Long Distance Call, which was one of six Twilight Zone episodes shot on black and white videotape. All the other episodes were shot on 35mm film, so that's really interesting to see how different those six look. And but Billy Mumy was just an amazing actor. This is before he did Lost in Space, and then I worked with him on Babylon 5 and now on Space Command, the show I've been shooting, but he's one of a kind.
Did you ever think when you were a youngster that you would be dealing with episodes like The Twilight Zone and writing about it and doing books on it and things like that?
Well, I dreamed of working in television when I was a kid. You know, the writers writing those shows were my heroes. And as soon as I was a teenager, I started going to science fiction conventions and meeting people like Ray Bradbury and so forth. And they became friends and mentors. So I've been just blessed by that. And I'll tell you, George, today I had one of the greatest experiences of my life. I shot a scene for Space Command with Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura on Star Trek. And I first met her when I was 10 years old and Star Trek was on the air.
Wow, that's amazing. Your Twilight Zone Companion that you wrote, the first edition, that was back in, 1982 or something?
Yeah, I started writing the book when I was 22 years old, and it came out in 1982. It's been in print ever since. But I really wanted to do a new edition that would expand upon the book. The new edition has over 100 pages of new material. It's got 500 new photos, and it's got links to audio and video, so you can watch and listen to some great stuff, like some of the TV shows Rod Serling wrote in the 50s, but you can also watch a new interview I just did with George Takei and listen to a new interview I just did with Rod's daughter, Jody. So the ability to do that was what really made me want to write the book.
Well, good for you. And this new edition is out now?
Yep, it's available from Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everywhere. Good books are sold.
Well, you know, if you love The Twilight Zone, you're going to love your Twilight Zone companions. That's
yes.
For sure. That's exciting. What do you think of the new TV Twilight Zone?
You know, it's really interesting because I really liked Jordan Peele's movies. I thought Get Out and Us were really in the tradition of what Rod Serling was up to. But the first two episodes that I've seen of the new Twilight Zone series that he's hosting, he didn't write or direct those episodes, and I felt they were not as strong as his movies have been. I was rather disappointed. I'm hoping that as the show continues, he'll have much more of a personal stamp on the new Twilight Zone, because, of course, in the original show, Rod Serling wrote 92 out of the 156 episodes himself, so it was very much his show. There was a very strong authorial voice. Rod was inseparable from Twilight Zone.
Well, you know, maybe you can't duplicate that.
Maybe not, but I think if Jordan Peele were writing and directing the shows and had much more of a hand on them, they would be have that quality that's made his film so strong. And we'll see, and perhaps as the show goes on, that will come to be the case. I'm rooting for it. I'm definitely rooting for it.
Is this show primarily streamed?
It's on CBS All Access, so you have to subscribe to it, just like Star Trek Discovery. CBS is basically taking some of their more successful properties and making new versions that people have to pay to see. It's sort of the new wave of how television is being delivered.
It is remarkable what's happening. Let's talk for a moment about that with Netflix and Amazon Prime and things like that, where people are paying premiums every month to be able to watch some premium shows. The days of the old three networks, I remember that a long time ago. That's gone. It's over now, isn't it?
It's true. It's astonishing. There's over 500 scripted comedy and drama series on all the networks and platforms right now. It's impossible to even know what shows are on the air. But you and I, of course, remember when we were kids that there were only three networks, and you had to watch a show when it was on. You couldn't. In fact, when the original Star Trek aired and I was 10 years old, I recorded the original Star Trek on reel-to-reel audio tape just in case Star Trek never showed again. So we've come a long way.
I remember when originally we just had CBS and NBC pounding each other in the ratings. ABC was a way distant third.
That's right.
Then all of a sudden, Fred Silverman took over, and ABC started coming up with some incredible programming, primarily gearing themselves to a younger, newer audience.
Yes.
And it worked for them.
Yes, and I think with Netflix and Amazon Prime and a lot of these new VOD platforms, they are appealing to younger people because a lot of young people have no idea what network or what studio is making given show. So, you know, for instance, you know, if they're watching Walking Dead or whatever, they may not be aware where it originated, and that's fine. So it's really deliverable content, and many people don't even have a TV set. They're watching them on their tablets or on their phones, you know, and so you really have to, it's a very new medium, and it's a very different way of watching television.
And what I think really made ABC back in the late 70s was when they came out with the Roots miniseries.
Yes, that was an amazing show. And again, it's one of those shows that, just like Game of Thrones nowadays, it's one of those shows that everyone was talking about, everyone was watching, and it really seized the imagination of the public. It was a terrific show.
Mark, with cable going on these days, is anybody watching the network evening news anymore?
Well, you know, it's really on the fade. You know, I think most people get their news from the internet or from, you know, their phone. Something dings, and you read a little capsule comment, and so it's very much changed. I mean, the days when Walter Cronkite was basically sort of the conscience of America, and everyone turned to him to get it. Well, for instance, when Walter Cronkite went to Vietnam and turned against the war, Lyndon Johnson said, "If we've lost Walter Cronkite, we've lost the war," and that kind of power you really don't see in these news people in the same way that you used.
That's right. I'll always remember back in 1963 when Cronkite broadcast John F. Kennedy's assassination.
Yes.
I mean, and he teared up.
Amazing,
and
yeah.
It was just unbelievable television.
Yes. And yet the fun part is those moments of authenticity that stick with us from back then, now the younger people or just anyone who's watching things on their computers or on their tablets, authenticity with the creator and with the personalities that we're watching, authenticity is what gets loyalty with the fans.
We've had Dan Rather on the show, who took Cronkite's place on CBS.
Wow.
And now, of course, he's been retired.
Yes, yes. You know, and time moves on, and, you know, it is a different world. I actually prefer the way media works now. I wouldn't go back to writing for the studios and networks the way it was when I started. I've been writing for TV since I was 22 years old, but I love the way things are now.
You do? You don't think it's too much?
No. No, I don't. Well, not for me, because my audience gave me over $1 million to shoot the Space Command pilot, and I'm in very direct communication with them now, and I love it because I'll tell you a funny story. I went to London to meet with the BBC, and I came out of the underground, the subway, and someone behind me on the street, on the sidewalk, said, "Mark Zickrey,
I love
Space Command," and he knew me from
I the love
YouTube
it.
Channel, you know, and so that's I love that stuff.
Stay with us, Mark. We're going to take a quick break. We will come back and talk about Space Command and where you're going with that program and some others. And the next hour, we open up the phone lines for all kinds of things about television, including Twilight Zone. Hey, you well know that our news editor of our coasttocoastam.com website is Tim Banal, and Tim comes up with incredible stories every day, and he highlights them as we put them on the coasttocoastam.com website. Tim, what do you have for us this week?
Hey, George, how you doing? Good
wonderful.
To talk to you again.
You too.
We got a couple of interesting stories here this week. Now, I was away over the weekend. I went down to Georgia to visit some of the paranormal hotspots. I want to give a quick shout-out to a guy named David Bacara, who runs the Expedition Bigfoot Sasquatch Museum in Cherry Log, Georgia. He's a big Coast fan, and he welcomed us with open arms down there. So I want to give a mention to that. When I got back from my trip, I was catching up on all the news that I'd missed. What I found interesting is I found this story of a big cat sighting in England. I don't know if you're familiar with this phenomenon.
Oh, yeah, it's huge everywhere.
Yes, these out-of-place giant black cats. Well, this guy, he noticed that something had scratched his pet Labrador, and he went out to the garden to look, and he had his flashlight out there, and he saw two large green eyes reflecting off the glow of his flashlight. And he realized, okay, I need to get away from this situation. He started kind of backing away, making noise, trying to look large, all the stuff they tell you to do in these kind of situations. The frightening part is this had no effect, and the cat started coming towards him. Luckily, he was able to get into his house, and, you know, he called the authorities later, and they came out to check it out. Now, this is the really mind-blowing part, in a sense, because a lot of times you see these videos, and you can't really kind of tell from the perspective. Is this a house cat that just looks really big because it's far away? The authorities found on his property a feline paw print that was 5 inches wide.
Ooh.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then over the course of the week, 3 or 4 more sightings popped up in England. So we're in the midst of a big cat flap going on in England right now. It'll be interesting to see how that develops. I got one more for you here that's really interesting. It's in the number 2 spot in the carousel. It's kind of funny. It's raining cats and dogs here right now in Boston, so it works perfectly. We just did the cats. Now I'm going to do the dogs.
You got it.
A demon dog photographed in England. As I said, it's in the number 2 spot right now. A woman in England was visiting a site known as Roundhay Park, and there they have a decorative castle that was built in 1811, rumored to be the home of a variety of spirits. While she was there, she took a picture. And there's this, as you can see in the number 2 spot on the carousel, this very strange blob, this dark blob that looks kind of like some kind of creature. And she believes that it is, a folkloric demon dog known as a Jytrash. That's the name of it, a Jytrash.
You've never heard of that before.
Yeah, I know, me neither, till today. And they're supposed to lurk in the various parks in this part of England. So I thought that was pretty wild. People can check that out in the number 2 spot and judge for themselves, see if they can figure out what this lady photographed.
Love it. We'll talk to you next week, Tim.
Thanks a lot, George.
Fantastic stuff. Tim Banal, our news editor at coasttocoastam.com, works with Sean and Lex, putting together some great material along with the Greg Bishop, too. They all do a great job. And by the way, I sent them a picture today that you'll see at coasttocoastam.com. In the carousel reel, it's one of the first pictures. Take a look at this thing. This was in my office. It is weird, weird, weird. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Mark Zickrey. To next hour, we'll take calls with Mark. Mark, tell us about the evolution of Space Command, your movie.
Yeah, well, it's been an amazing journey, George. As you and I know, you know, I've worked for many decades in television, wrote for all the major studios and networks, and in fact, you and I even worked on a project together, a drama series that was derived from your life and your experience.
We almost pulled that one off, too, didn't we?
We did at Universal and Fox. It was an amazing journey, but I became increasingly aware of how much I was frustrated by the networks and studios getting to decide, not just for me, but for many series creators, what got made, what got to the audience. And I run a roundtable here in Los Angeles where I mentor thousands of young people in the industry. And I started hearing about crowdfunding, and I said, well, I've never raised money, but let's see if I can. I wanted to do a space-going show like Star Trek had been for me when I was a kid, something that said we can reach out across boundaries and barriers with compassion and create a future worth living in, and something that would be hopeful and encourage people and inspire them without being preachy. And a lot of my friends who run network shows said, well, let's partner up and we can go in and get a pilot deal. But I didn't want to get cut off at script or cut off at pilots. So I said, well, let's see if I can raise money. So we did a Kickstarter campaign, and our target was $75,000 to raise in 2 months. And we raised that in 3 days and kept going and raised $221,000. And that was enough for me to open my own studio, and with Doug Jones, who starred in Shape of Water and now stars in Star Trek Discovery, and many other science fiction stars, including Bill Mumy, we were able to shoot the 2-hour pilot of what was projected to be a 12-hour first season, and now we're in post on that. And as I said, my audience ultimately gave me, between Kickstarter and selling investment shares, of $7,500 each, I was able to raise over $1 million.
My God.
Yeah, and now I have my own YouTube channel called Mr. Sci-Fi, where I post about science fiction. I've just put the first hour of the Space Command pilot on Mr. Sci-Fi, and we're getting 95% thumbs up, and we're heading toward 1 million views, and it's just astonishing. So anyone listening can just go on Mr. Sci-Fi and watch that pilot, and we shot a good chunk of the second two-hour story, and in fact, that was where I was shooting with Nichelle Nichols today, and we're going to be launching a Kickstarter campaign on Monday to shoot the rest of that two-hour story. And meantime, I'm pitching it to the networks and the VOD platforms, but they're not determining what gets made and what doesn't get made. They can come aboard as my partner and help promote and help distribute and all of that. But I'm going to be making what I want to make, and the fact that my audience will allow me to greenlight anything I want to make gives me enormous freedom.
We can always say we knew you when.
Yes.
That's fantastic, Mark. Good for you. We're proud of you because it's been years since we've been interviewing you, and just to watch your evolution explode is just fantastic. So best of luck.
Fun because you know I get to work with people that I love to work with. You and I, from the first moment we met and spoke on Coast to Coast, we just clicked, and you have a certain chemistry with people where you just love working with them and you love talking to them. And so to be able to just reach out to any of the actors that I love in the science fiction world, and also people like Mike Harney from Orange is the New Black, who's now in Space Command, it's just a joy. I love working with actors. I love the collaboration of working with people who I so admire. And they don't see a difference between what I'm doing and what the networks are doing. I had dinner the other night with Doug Jones, who's a huge star. He was the creature in Shape of Water. He's Saru in Star Trek Discovery. But, you know, he's working on Space Command, and he's happy to do it. He loves doing it because the writing is good, the characters are great, and the audience just loves what we're doing.
What's this book, Greenlighting Yourself, all about?
Well, because I mentor so many people and I see how many people who want to be actors or writers or directors or producers get stymied and frustrated because they're waiting for the networks or the studios to wave their magic wand, and they spend years with projects that are extremely viable, and yet they're frustrated. And so what I've been learning now, where if you it's funny because if you have a cell phone in your pocket and a computer and you're on the internet, you have your own studio because you have a camera in your cell phone. You can edit on your computer, and you can reach audiences of millions of people around the world. You know, when I was going to shoot the Nichelle Nichols scene for Space Command, I reached out to my audience for the money to be able to shoot it. And by the next morning, someone had contacted me from Switzerland, and within 2 days, the money was in the Space Command bank account, and we were able to roll camera. And so I want to teach people what I've learned to not wait, to just follow their dreams, and step by step, I'll be telling them exactly how they can do it. And we're writing the book now, and it comes out later this year.
Now, tell us more about the Showrunners Network. This is exciting.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm as if Space Command isn't crazy big enough. You know, we're going to be shooting the entire 12 hours of Space Command this year. I have this interesting idea because, as I mentioned to you, there are over 500 scripted comedy and drama series, and it's a huge number. And so I noticed more and more with the billboards for different shows that were coming out, they weren't using the names of the actors to promote the show. They were using the name of the showrunner, the creator of the show, the executive producer running the show. And so it would be from the creator of Mad Men or from the showrunner, from the executive producer of Walking Dead. So I have very many friends who run network shows who have created some of the top shows of all time. So I've had this idea where I would reach out to six of them, I would co-create and co-write six pilots, lay out six series.
Wow.
We would go to our audience, finance all six pilots, shoot them as a slate of six new shows, and then go to the buyers saying, this is six new shows that we want to do as a slate. And so far, I'm writing the first pilot now with a friend of mine who's created many, many hit science fiction shows, and another friend of mine who has a very big hit show on the air now and wrote one of the highest grossing movies of all time. And so it'll be six people of that ilk and of that quality. And I sat down and I generated 350 ideas for series in a matter of a few weeks. And so I share the list with my collaborators, and we either choose one of those, or we come up with something that they have in their back pocket, or, you know, it's a very fluid and a very fun collaboration. I'm really enjoying it.
We're with Mark Zakrie. Mark, what is it about sci-fi that is almost universal, where everybody seems to like it?
Well, I think it's because it takes it out of the current moment. So whereas you might have a political conversation that would immediately get you into a polarized situation where you're arguing over this or that, and you go into sort of armed camps and you don't accomplish anything, in science fiction, by taking it out of the current moment, you people can see that there's something that we all want, a future for our kids. We all want everyone to be safe and happy and well taken care of and have, you know, medical treatment and all of the things. You can agree on the common ground. So Rod Serling, who was politically liberal, people can still love Twilight Zone, whether they're liberal or conservative, because they say, well, no one wanted nuclear war. No one wanted the future that he would be warning about. And so that continues now with Star Trek or any of the shows that are on now. It removes the barriers. You know, when I talk about reaching across boundaries and barriers with compassion, I'm not just talking about boundaries and barriers of race or religion. I'm talking about political boundaries, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm politically liberal, but some of the people supporting Space Command are Trump supporters or they're liberal, and I don't ask for their voting record. If they can share a hopeful vision, if they can come to the table with compassion and a good heart and understanding that we're all here to make a future for all of us that we can live in and be happy and be healthy, you know, I'm fine. I don't need someone to tell me what they're you know, who they voted for in the last election. That's not the point.
What's amazing, Mark, is the Rod Serling topics would be so apropos today.
Yeah.
They would all fit in.
Yes, they do, and that's why Twilight Zone is still hugely successful. I have a sister who's 20 years younger than me, and when she became a fan of Twilight Zone, I knew that the show was going to last forever, because it's not about Nikita Khrushchev, it's not about any of that stuff, it's about the future, it's about our world, and those issues of life and death and love and alienation and all of that stuff. Is as relevant now as ever.
I guess it's difficult to ask, do you have a favorite Twilight Zone episode?
It's an interesting question, George. I love Walking Distance, which is Rod Serling's personal favorite, where a man goes back to his hometown and he's back in the past of his childhood. And Rod, when he was in the Army in World War II, his father died and he wasn't able to take a leave to go to the funeral. And this is the episode where he goes back in time and sort of gets to say goodbye to his father. So it was a very personal episode. It's called Walking Distance. Gig Young stars in it. It's great. But, of course, we all love the ones about Talkie Tina and the Gremlin on the Wing. And,
yeah.
You know, there's so many great episodes.
I loved Willoughby, too.
Yes, it's a wonderful episode. James Daly is so great in that episode.
And Billy Mumy was always a classic. I mean,
yeah.
he's just, and he never ages.
No, he's got a youthful heart, you know, and every time I work with him, I first met him when I was seven. You know, I called him when I was homesick one day. I was just calling the stars of Lost in Space out of the blue. And we became friends, and we've known each other since then. And I recently came upon the photo of him as Will Robinson that he signed to me when I was 7 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Amazing. I'm so blessed to have this life.
Now, how old would he have been?
He's a couple years older than me, so he would have been maybe 9 or 10. Not old at all.
A 9 or 10-year-old signing autographs to a 7-year-old.
Yes,
that's cool.
Exactly. Now here we are working together on Space Command and just having a ball. So.
And, of course, I'll always admire and love the gift you got for me, and that was when I wrote that editorial about I Sing the Body Electric, written by Ray Bradbury.
Yes.
And put it in our then After Dark newsletter, and we sent a copy of that to Ray, and he just loved it.
Yes.
And
well,
sent me that personal letter because of you. And I've still got it up there on my bulletin board.
Yes, well, I mean, these are there's no one like Ray Bradbury. There's no one like any of these people, Rod Serling. And when you connect with them and you get a personal experience with them, it's so rewarding, so meaningful. I first saw Ray Bradbury when I was 10 years old at a library. He was the first writer I ever saw in person. And at that talk, he said, ideally, your life and your work and your art should all come from the same place. And he reached to his heart. And when he became a friend and mentor in the later decade of his life to me, I'd go over once a month to his house and we'd just sit and talk about everything. And I'm writing a book now called My Ray Bradbury, and it's about the experience of him being a friend and mentor.
Did Rod Serling ever meet Alfred Hitchcock?
You know, I'm sure he did, because Rod was a very social person. He was the head of the Television Academy. The Hitchcock Show was on at the same time as Twilight Zone. I'm certain he met and admired Hitchcock. And of course, he knew Ray Bradbury. I mean, a lot of these people were friends and palled around and hung around together. One time, Ray Bradbury was in a supermarket. He ran into Walt Disney, and the next day they had lunch at Disney Studio, and they just had a great time. And Walt said to Ray, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And Ray said, "Open your vaults." And he called down and he opened up the Disney vaults, and Ray filled his arms with animation cells and all these things he loved and took them home. He had carte blanche to take home anything he wanted to take home.
Did you know anybody from Hollywood writers or anybody who was blacklisted during that horrible period in Hollywood?
I've met a few of those people, particularly when I was a student at UCLA. They would come and talk, and it was a very dark period. And you know, the only reason Serling wasn't blacklisted was because, as well as being anti-fascist, he was anti-communist. So he was, he was against anything that squeezed the individual. He was hugely against conformity or the state overwhelming the individual. These were very strong feelings on his part. So he wasn't blacklisted, but he certainly knew people who were.
Well, let's take phone calls with you next hour, Mark. Mark Zakrie with us. Let's take some phone calls about the Twilight Zone, about Space Command, about television in general. Jump on board Mark's website. They're all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And just a reminder, he's got the brand new Twilight Zone companion out and done and ready to read. We'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM with your calls and Mark Zakrie.